we inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to At the Core here on American Family Radio. I'm Walker Wildman. I'm your host for the program today. Rick Green and I, we're your host each week on the program, rotating days. And on this edition, you've got me for the hour, and we're going to have a good show and hopefully bring you a lot of content and information that maybe you wouldn't have otherwise heard or learned. Let's turn our attention to the scripture, and then we'll jump into some of the news of the day. Proverbs chapter 10, verse 1, a wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish son is a grief to his mother. A wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish son is a grief to his mother. What do we draw away from this? Well, we ought to seek to follow one of the Ten Commandments, and that is to honor your father and mother. And when you do so, you will make your father glad, and you will avoid bringing grief upon your mother. That's Proverbs chapter 10, verse 1. There in that proverb. Several events that we have going on that I want to highlight and some special projects. We have our annual Ten Commandments Speech Challenge coming up in over the next, let's say, 6 to 8 weeks. It's going to end June 30th, and the entire month of June is when we're going to begin fielding these speeches. But just to give you a little background, or if you haven't heard of this project, we give young people, boys and girls, the opportunity to present a 1, 2, 3 minute speech on the Ten Commandments. And looking at this year, this is for youth age 7 to 17. And this year, they're invited to write and present a 3 to 5 minute speech on the topic of the first commandment. What is the first commandment? You shall have no other gods before me. Participants may receive assistance from a parent or a sibling to write, record, and submit the speech. Speeches must be submitted by June 30th. All participants will receive a Ten Commandments t-shirt, bookmark, and coupon code to use in our resource center. So there is somewhat of a participation not trophy, but you're going to get something out of it if you participate. And if you win, you'll get more. And we'll bring you more of that information in the coming weeks. But this is our annual Ten Commandments Speech Challenge for youth ages 7 to 17. We just are looking for about a 3 to 5 minute speech that's recorded on video of you emphasizing and talking about the importance of the first commandment. You shall have no other gods before me. You can go over to afr.net/10, spelled out T-E-N, commandments, and find out all the instructions and how to submit your speech. afr.net/10, spelled out commandments, and you can check out all the information. It's a 4-step process, pretty simple, and a great opportunity to get young people involved in reciting the scripture. And it teaches how to give a speech, how to look at the camera, how to read and focus. And there's a lot of skills that are learned here. And the most important one is that we need to follow the Ten Commandments. A few other things I want to mention are our Activate Summit. Registration is actually closed on that, but we look forward to seeing many of you in June at our Activate Summit. And then as we head towards next year, and then I'll say this and then we'll move on. We've got a couple of tours coming up that we do, these spiritual heritage tours that we do all around the country or all around the world, really, whether it's in Greece, Israel, Boston, Washington, D.C. We're going to be heading to Greece and Israel back to back in March of next year. So in about 11 months, 10 or 11 months. We're going to be in March. We're going to be in Greece and Israel in March of 2026. Those back-to-back trips. They're separate tours, but if you want to do both back-to-back, you can, of course, register for both, and we'll be sure you get transferred from Tel Aviv over to Greece to meet us there. So it's going to be a great trip. First time going to Greece, at least for my brother and I. We're going to lead a trip there with many Christians from the U.S., and so we look forward to that. And then our Israel trip, we've been doing that for 27, 28 years. My dad has, and my brother and I have been doing it for about a decade. And so we're looking forward to seeing everyone on those two trips. You can go over to wildmangroup.com to check out the dates and the itinerary and all the information you need to register. All right, let's jump into some clips here. Let's look at clip one. This is the, once again, we're looking at the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent. And the topic here is the supply chain and how the tariff strategy and the reshoring of America's manufacturing industry is about more than just jobs, about more than just GDP. It's about more than just a booming economy. There's some critical national security conversations that need to be had that a lot of the economists are completely missing out on because they're so hung up on the tariff talk. Let's listen to clip one.
Well, look, the bringing back our strategic, our important strategic industries can be a result of tariffs, but it's also a result of national will. So this administration is running full speed to make sure that what we saw during COVID never happens again. So it's a combination of, it can be tariffs, but again, it is the administration moving as quickly as possible to make sure that we are self-sufficient in the strategic industries.
All right, so that's Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, and he's been honestly one of the best spokespersons and articulators of the president's policies here. But I have to highlight, and this really hasn't been highlighted enough. I'm glad Bessent went this direction. But we can have a debate about tariff rates and the effects of tariffs, and we've done it on the program. We had on Jerry Boyer to talk about his view of tariffs. He's not a fan of tariffs, doesn't like them, thinks they're bad for the consumer. But when you take this conversation beyond what the price of goods is or will be, might be, and should the president have this authority or not, well, that's on Congress. This tariff authority, at least under emergency authorization, has been given to the president. And so if you want Congress to rein in executive authority, well, that's a good discussion to have. And I think in some instances, it's a very, very, it would be a positive discussion. But when you get hung up on what the tariff rates are and are my China goods going to go up by 5% because of the tariffs or whatever, then, and you don't talk about the strategic move here, the national security angle, you're not painting a whole picture. You're not painting a whole picture. And I think it's being a disservice to the voters by not talking about the big picture here. Well, what is the big picture? The big picture is that we're relying way too heavily on China. And it's not that we're relying way too heavily on China for toys or iPhones. We're relying way too heavily on China for critical things that are needed to live. All right? And when we look at let's just talk about the pharmaceutical industry and the pharmaceutical supply chain. About 80% of the active pharmaceutical ingredients, APIs, used to make drugs in the U.S. are said to come from either China or countries like India. This is according to Council on Foreign Relations. 80%. And so you can say, well, the U.S. produces X amount of our own drugs. Well, okay, where are they getting those core ingredients from? Well, they're getting it from China or India. That's a problem. Another category that China is just dominating the market on is these rare earth minerals. And if you think that, well, China would surely never weaponize rare earth minerals against the U.S., you're wrong, because they just did. 4 weeks ago, this is a headline from Reuters. China hits back at the U.S. over the tariffs with export controls on key rare earths. This is out of London. China placed export restrictions on rare earth elements on Friday as part of its sweeping response to President Trump's tariffs, squeezing supply to the West of minerals used to make weapons, electronics, and a range of consumer goods. The move, once again, I'm still reading from Reuters, which Beijing had long hinted was possible, further ratchets up trade tensions between the world's two largest economies and leaves American manufacturers scrambling for fresh supplies of the critical minerals they have relied upon for decades. All right. And so I think this is important from a public perception standpoint and a talking points for the White House to continue hammering home. Because if not, then we're dumbing this tariff debate down to a debate on whether we want to pay a dollar for a toy or $1.50. And unfortunately, some of the studies have shown that consumers pick the China products over the U.S. products. And they do that because they're all about getting the cheaper product. And that's an unfortunate thing. There's actually been some A/B testing on this from different companies where they've posted, hey, this product's from China and it's a little bit cheaper, and this product's made in the U.S. and it's a little bit costly. But the consumers, unfortunately, tend to flock towards the made in China products just from a simple economic standpoint. But if you dumb it down to just economics and who's going to pay more and what are the cost of goods, then that's missing the big picture here. And the big picture is that we don't get in another predicament like we did during COVID, where our whole supply chain gets thrown in a tizzy over China. And if you were naive enough to think that China would never threaten us, China would never withhold rare earth minerals from the U.S. over some kind of dispute, well, you're wrong, because they just got done doing it 5 weeks ago. Over the tariff debate. So we've got to get back to producing some of these critical industries in the U.S. Now, it's one thing if we want to have some toys made in China or T-shirts made in China, whatever. You know, I don't expect everybody to flee China, but we can't have insulin. We can't have these critical pharmaceutical drugs continue to be dominated by China, along with the rare earth minerals that are now used in the defense industry, in the tech industry. We've got the boom of AI. We just cannot expect to leave the majority of the supply chain in China's hands and then think that's going to go well. It's just not going to go well at all. And unfortunately, we don't have the upper hand in many regards when it comes to these situations, because we're beholden to China to a large degree. And I think this whole tariff talk has highlighted the vulnerabilities that we have in the U.S. supply chain. Another stat that I wanted to highlight before we wrap up this subject, when it comes to the rare earth minerals, China dominates the refining and processing of rare earth minerals, controlling about 85% of the global processing capacity. This isn't 40%, 50%. China is the largest producer of rare earth metals, accounting for 70% of global mine production. And then they control 85% of the processing capacity, or the refining capacity. That's a problem. And I think if we articulate that to the American consumer, they're okay with some tariffs for a time if it means we reshore these industries.
Did you know that every day, Preborn's network of clinics experiences hundreds of miracles? How? Preborn gives women with unplanned pregnancies a window into their womb through free ultrasounds.
And I saw my baby on the sonogram picture. He had a little halo around his head. And I heard his heartbeat. And seeing the heartbeat, it really hit home that, oh my gosh, there's a miracle growing inside of my womb.
Because of you, when you donate to sponsor an ultrasound, Preborn is able to offer women the blessing of life. Someday, you may meet a baby that you rescued, and you can give them a hug. Or maybe they'll give you a hug. To learn more about their life-saving work, dial pound 250 and say the keyword baby. That's pound 250, baby. Or visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible. Your love can save a life.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the program here on American Family Radio. Just to put a bow on the topic that we were covering in the last segment, I've got one more clip on the Treasury Secretary. And this has to do with the China and the trade deal that President Trump struck in the first term and them not holding up their end of the deal. And this is, once again, we have to jog our memories about how this went down. But China basically, no, they didn't basically, they reneged completely on the trade deal that President Trump struck with them, where they were supposed to buy billions of dollars in agricultural products from U.S. farmers. And when Biden got in there, they dropped the whole deal, didn't follow through with it at all. And this is the deal that President Trump struck in, let's say, around 2019, 2020 with China. And so this is Scott Bessent talking about China not following through on their previous trade agreement, clip two.
What has to happen is it has to be fair for the American people. But in January 2020, President Trump produced a template. We had an excellent trade agreement with China, and the Biden administration chose not to enforce it. The Chinese delegation basically told us that once President Biden came into office, they just ignored their obligations. So, we all already have a large framework.
All right, well, there you have it. That's clip two. That's Scott Bessent on China not holding up their end of the deal last Trump term. And that probably explains the more aggressive nature that Trump is using with China when it comes to these trade discussions. Well, I do want to introduce our next guest. We have with us Kendall Teitz, if I'm pronouncing that right, probably not, investigative reporter with Defending Education, defendinged.org. Kendall's with us now. Hey, Kendall, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Tell me how to pronounce your last name, because I probably got it wrong.
It's Teitz. So close, but a lot of people say it the way you did.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, my last name's Wildman, and I can't tell you how many times I get Mr. Wildman. So I totally...
People get very creative with it.
Yes, exactly. So yes. I usually just give them the liberty. Kendall, welcome to the program. Once again, Kendall's an investigative reporter with Defending Education. And Kendall, there's been a huge pushback in recent years against diversity, equity, inclusion, DEI, which on the surface might sound good, it sounds fuzzy, maybe sounds virtuous, but what's been uncovered in recent years, thanks to the work of you and others, is that DEI is very toxic. It has very Marxist humanist roots. It actually divides people. It doesn't unify people. And a lot of parents have been waking up to this, and thankfully a lot of educators and governors and other officials waking up to this reality. So bring us up to speed on this whole DEI funding report that you guys have put out and where we are now.
Great. Yeah. So very true. What Defending Education has found in one of our numerous reports about DEI in higher ed that we've rolled out, given our expansion into higher education from K through 12, is that since 2021, over $373 million has been funneled into DEI programs, that's diversity, equity, and inclusion, across 130 US colleges and universities. So these funds, they support DEI offices and identity-based scholarships, as well as other race-based programs, staff positions, training, and DEI infrastructure. And these funds are often without public transparency or academic accountability. It's really unclear who is contributing to these funds, especially because they're often established through university foundations or so-called Day of Giving campaigns. So there's really kind of a lack of transparency regarding, donor identity and, fund allocation. So that's what we've found. And at, like I said, over 130 US colleges and universities across the country. And I think, this is especially salient given what we've seen out of the Trump administration. There's been kind of a crackdown on this, and changing the name of these different scholarships, funds, whatever, doesn't at the end of the day change the merits or the core of what they might be trying to do.
Yeah, this is, I don't know whether I'm naive or I just had my head in the sand on this, but the level at which that this had saturated and permeated America's higher ed, and even lower, K through 12, maybe they didn't call it DEI, they called it something else, but just to see how rampant this was. And then you look at what DOGE has uncovered, where the government was spending hundreds of millions of dollars in these DEI contracts, having these basically woke training sessions for executive agencies. It's just shocking to me. I mean, I just don't see this. DEI doesn't get me excited. Like, it doesn't get me like, yeah, we need DEI. But apparently, this was rampant. I mean, the left had really latched onto this, and this had almost become like a religious tenet of being a Marxist. You have to do DEI. What do you think about, and this report, by the way, is very helpful, just looking at some of the top line numbers you guys have put out. This number of states where you discovered or uncovered this funding, according to your investigation, is in 44 states plus DC. And then this affects roughly 130 colleges. The number of funds, 281 funds. So that means some of these colleges and universities had multiple funds. What do you see? Here's my concern, and I want to get your opinion on this. My concern is a rebrand. My concern is that, yes, I think the Trump administration is genuinely ditching the DEI in large part. And I think his executive order actually mentions, like, hey, you guys can't rebrand this. I don't care what you call it. We're not doing DEI in principle. But my concern is that some of these states just rebrand it, right, and come up with some new fancy talking point that sounds great, and then we still have DEI. What are you thinking on that? Is that a viable concern, or do you think DEI is truly being ditched?
I mean, like I said, in some cases, captured in our report, universities just use the same giving account number and would change kind of those DEI buzzwords that we've seen all over, to examples like belonging or inclusive excellence. And, it was clear that that does not, like I said, change kind of the meaning behind what these funds are supposed to do. And people can agree or disagree about the value of these programs, but in cases where they're using race or sex to include or exclude participants, that's a violation of federal law.
Yes.
And that is, what we've seen, Trump's cracking down on DEI because it's in response to these pervasive examples of, Title VI violations.
Yeah.
And so, I know you mentioned kind of at the, maybe states are rebranding, but really, we see this as a violation of federal law. Pretty much any time, you're discriminating on the basis of race, color, or national origin.
Yeah, this is textbook DEI to its furthest degree is textbook segregation. And, America fought a civil war long before even the whole Martin Luther King civil rights dispute, our battle fight. We had, of course, a whole civil war over the slavery issue. And then, of course, you have segregation and Jim Crow, and we can go through all the history. But, I mean, America has a pretty in-depth history, a pretty expansive history, not in a positive sense, but over the issue of discriminating against people based on immutable characteristics. And you look at this and go, have we not learned anything? Like, we fought a whole civil war over discrimination based on immutable characteristics, and here we are developing funds so that we can discriminate against white people, basically, or males, right? Because masculinity is somehow a bad thing. And then we can, you know, we can lift up, quote, the victim and the oppressed, and then demonize, you know, the majority, if you will, or who's viewed as the aggressor. But to your point about rebranding, I like that you, in this report, once again, we're looking at this Defending Education report that was put out. And you, in this report, you actually look at some of the rebrands. And for example, right here at the top of the report is where the University of Nebraska-Lincoln actually did a rebrand, exactly what you're talking about. And instead of calling it, you know, basically the DEI fund, they started calling it the Community and Belonging Support Fund, but it has the same fund ID number. So the money's going to the same place. And they think that we're not going to catch on to this, but everything's the same. They went in the website and changed out a few words and thought, well, we're just going to be fine now. But that definitely didn't trick me, and I'm sure it didn't trick you guys, Kendall.
Definitely not. And, you know, like I've said, we really need to ensure transparency from these universities. You know, they should be responsible for publicly disclosing detailed reports on DEI, how it's funded, allocated, what the expenditures are, identify donors and the specific purposes of their contributions. That was often murky a lot of times. And what we found, like I mentioned, there was a lack of transparency about where this money was coming from. In certain instances, you know, you could look to university foundations, alumni, you know, some private foundations, philanthropic organizations and whatnot that are, you know, responsible for this funding. But there does need to be, you know, some transparency and accountability on the part of, you know, these higher education institutions.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And especially when you're looking at tax dollars. I mean, this is... most of this, if not all of these universities that you are included in this report, are in some way subsidized by the government, whether it's state or federal. And not to mention the entire premise of DEI at its core, the ideology itself is against the Civil Rights Act, because you're discriminating against people based on the attributes that are described in the Civil Rights Act. And so it's illegal, but then what makes it even more egregious is that they're using taxpayer dollars to subsidize it. And I would be surprised, Kendall, that this is, maybe there's a lot of donors out there that like DEI. I mean, we're a 50-50 country. There's a lot of Democrats out there. So, you know, I think this has some support amongst the Marxists and the Democrats. But the level of support that I'm looking at, Kendall, it seems as though this is probably being underwritten in large part by multi-million and multi-billionaire donors that are far-left Soros types. Is that a wrong conclusion? Is this grassroots, or do you think that this is being funded at the top by some major left-wing billionaires?
Yes. I mean, you know, you've got groups like the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, which donated $4 million to Florida International University to establish a digital transformation program aimed at supporting food entrepreneurs of color. So
Please tell me you're making that up, Kendall.
I can quote it here, to establish the digital transformation program at Startup FIU Food, an online platform to help people of color who are food entrepreneurs. So, you know, we have a whole list of these examples. You can go check them out in the report. I highly recommend it. There's comedic nuggets like that throughout. But, you know, like I said, definitely there are groups that are very influential and have lots of money that are are behind this a lot of the time. And it's, you know, people with influence, like I said.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you have the whole Democrat Party apparatus is behind this. And what I want to end on is the ultimate goal when you look at, and this is a little bit above my pay grade, but I do read and I do listen to people who are experts on this, and that is the underlying roots of DEI is at its core Marxism. And the purpose, and this you can look at China and look at other countries that practice this, but the goal is to undermine American culture, to create like a victim class, a permanent, this isn't a temporal, this is a permanent victim class based on immutable characteristics. And then you divide everybody, and there's the aggressors, and then there's the victims, and everybody's pitted against each other, and we've got to prop one up, and we've got to punish the other simply based on skin color or our sex, and it ultimately brings down a culture. I mean, am I pretty much summarizing the end result if this DEI were to continue permeating our society?
Yeah, you bring up a good point. I mean, it definitely does have Marxist origins. We saw this with critical race theory. I mean, that was a buzzword 2020, 2021, which was ultimately kind of exposed for what it was. DEI came in kind of as, you know, maybe a softer sounding alternative that was institutionalized across, you know, education, healthcare, I mean, you name it, all of our industries in the business world. And it's really, really permeated kind of our society's ideology in recent years. But I do think that people are waking up and they're realizing kind of what this really means. I know you said at the outset that it's, you know, might sound great on the surface, and that's, you know, in theory, it maybe could have been, but once we see really how this ideology plays out, it's ultimately, you know, dividing people by race, by sex, and, you know, nobody benefits from tribalism in that way.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Hey, Kendall, thanks so much for coming on. Tell our folks your URL real quick.
For the website or the report?
Yeah, Defending Ed.
Yeah, you can find our work at defendinged.com or sorry, .org /investigations, but more generally just defendinged.com.
Excellent. All right. Hey, thanks, Kendall. Appreciate you coming on.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
All right. Defending Ed is the organization, defendinged.org. Check it out. We'll be back in a few.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. Glad to have you with us in this last segment of the program. Well, let's talk health. Let's talk RFK Jr. Let's talk Department of Health and Human Services. And the recent story or headline that the media has just tried to get us all worked up about is the measles. And the media started this highlighting of the measles cases in the U.S. Since January, since President Trump was sworn in, even though this was an issue that existed under Biden. This issue goes back under the Biden administration. But all of a sudden, we don't highlight it. We don't harp on it. We don't ask questions about it when Biden's in charge. And then all of a sudden, President Trump takes over and RFK Jr. gets sworn in as health secretary. And every day it's about, what do you think about the measles? What are you doing to stop the measles? What are you doing to control the measles outbreak? And here's the common theme. If you want to kind of get a tip, if you will, into how the mainstream conglomerate media operates. These are the legacy media organizations. They're in bed with the Democrat Party. They fund the Democrat Party. They parrot the talking points. They feed questions to the candidates. They are one in the same. I mean, this, the major media conglomerates. Now, thankfully, there is a rising up of independent media. There's outfits like AFR, but the legacy ABCs, NBCs, CNNs of the world, they're an arm of the Democrat Party. That's a fact, okay? You look at their funding, look at their campaign contributions, look at their ideology. It's heavily Democratic operated. And where I'm going with this is that if you want a tip into how these folks operate and how to spot their dishonesty and their uncalled for hysteria, they hardly ever focus on the things that really matter. And this measles situation is Exhibit A, all right? When you look at the rate of occurrence, when you look at the number of cases, this is far from apocalyptic. It's far from even concerning. Because RFK Jr. is actually going to highlight in this clip the number of cases in Canada and in Mexico, and the fact that this is not a big deal. It's just not a big deal. And then how you know they're focused on the wrong things is because I can tell you 10 things that are a big deal, but the journalists don't want to ask questions about it. And so before I get into all the things that are problematic that really we should be asking questions about, this is RFK Jr. responding to a Democrat question in a hearing in Congress about the measles outbreak and how Canada and Mexico have the real problems, and instead we might should focus on that and not that the U.S. has a problem and try to turn this into a scandal. Clip three.
Let me address your first issue first, because I want to correct you. We have about 1,100 measles cases in this country. The growth rate last year was 15 additional, so we have plateaued. Mexico has roughly the same number with a third of our population, and they got 300 extra cases last week. Canada has more measles, 1,500. They have 1/8 of our population. Your Western Europe has about 6,000, which is 10 times the number that we have. Well, oh, you are wrong about what you said earlier.
Yeah, you're wrong. You're trying to turn this into a RFK Jr. is anti-vax and everybody's going to die because RFK Jr. is at HHS and the measles are going crazy. Give me a break. I mean, give me an absolute break. And this is why Trump gets the votes. Because he puts people in power that aren't towing the talking points. They're not towing the party line. They're not playing nice. They're just telling it how it is. And she's wrong. And either she's woefully unprepared, uneducated, or she's lying. I'm talking about the congresswoman. And when you look at the numbers, America doesn't have a measles problem, okay? We just don't. I'll tell you what we do have a problem with. We've got a diabetic problem. But we can't talk about that because that doesn't make the pharmaceutical industry money. Oh, wait, it does if you encourage to get folks to get Ozempic or get the shot or do anything but control their own lifestyle. And so the media, back to the media and the Democrats, they're not interested in anything that's actually important. They're only interested in the topics that they can weaponize and turn into a scandal. And this measles topic is the perfect scenario where we don't have a problem, but they want to make a problem. Why not to end the measles outbreak to whatever extent it is an outbreak? What is the definition of an outbreak, right? And instead, they want to make RFK Jr. look bad, basically, is what they're trying to do here. And it's very dishonest, it's very low, and it's not helpful. And this is why people are fleeing the Democrat Party. They're completely an unserious party. They're really not interested in fixing anything. I mean, this is the party of breaking everything. They touch everything they touch, they break. And and that's how you know it's spiritual. Because who else breaks everything they touch? Satan, the author of lies. And when you look at things that are a problem that maybe they should be asking RFK Jr. about, and we should be having public discourse about, is things like the diabetes, the rising diabetes numbers amongst youth. Amongst youth, this used to not be a thing. Here we are. Listen to these stats. These stats are from, these are type 2 diabetes numbers. And once again, a lot of this comes from unhealthy eating practices. This comes from, this data is from 2002 to 2018. All right. So roughly a 16-year window. There was a 5% increase, not over a 16-year period, per year for diabetes type 2 amongst youth in America. And the new cases of type 1 increased about 2% per year. So 2% for type 1 diabetes and 5% per year on type 2 diabetes. These are hundreds of thousands of young people that should not be going to a doctor talking about diabetes. But our food supply chain is full of junk. It's full of junk. Added sugars, ultra-processed foods, all these fake dyes. And the FDA has just been rubber stamping it. I don't know why. Is it kickbacks? Is it they just don't care? Are they bought off? I have no idea. I'm not in the room. I have no idea why the FDA has been signing off on all of this garbage. But yet we've got breakthrough cancer cures, and they're doing clinical trials for 8 years. Listen to this. I just watched this 2-hour interview with a doctor from UCLA who's got a breakthrough cancer shot technology. I'm not going to call it a vaccine, but it's a cancer technology that basically enables your good cells to fight the cancer cells. It's a very simple kind of concept, but he's had to do clinical trials for 8 years because he can't get the FDA to sign off on this. But we have this COVID outbreak, this upper respiratory, basically a bad cold, released out of Wuhan, China by the Chinese and Fauci's buddies. And they don't even do clinical trials for it. They just rush it to market despite all the concerns. And we don't even know the long-term effects of the shot because nobody's looking at it. But everybody's got to get it. If not, you're fired. No religious exemptions. And if anybody criticizes it, well, you're anti-vax. And do you see the common theme here? They don't focus on things that matter and things that work and things that bring about true solutions. And instead, they focus on all these tertiary issues that don't really matter in the grand scheme of life in America. And that's the common occurrence. And that's your brief, that's your 7-minute tip as to how you can spot who's on your side or not. What are they focusing on? What are they highlighting? What are they talking about? And they seem to very, very infrequently talk about things that actually matter. What else actually matters? All right, here's another issue that ought to be talked about more. And we ought to be looking at what on earth is going on here. And that is the rate of antidepressant use amongst minors. Once again, I keep focusing on kids because kids and the elderly are the most vulnerable amongst us, all right? And when a 20-year-old, when a 30-year-old, when a 40-year-old makes a decision in life, at some point we can't influence them, right? We can tell people our opinions, we can give them good advice, but adults simply and unfortunately have the liberty to make bad decisions sometimes. And so I keep highlighting these stats on young people because as parents, it's our job to foster a healthy, safe environment for young people and for our children. So back to this stat on antidepressants. From 2005 to 2014, this is amongst 12 to 19-year-olds, antidepressant prescriptions have doubled, 50%. They've doubled. Actually, that'd be 100%. Antidepressant use has doubled from 12 to 19-year-olds in a 9-year window, not a 30-year window, in a 9-year window. What on earth is going on here? Well, there may be a couple things going on here, but we've seen during that same period, we have a continual degradation of the American family structure as God designed it. You have continued woke education that doesn't talk about God, but talks all about humanism and evolution and how we're just, you know, a descendants of monkeys. We're feeding them this TikTok, Instagram poison of what life is supposed to look like, even though it's all fake. It's all Botox. And then on top of this, you've got a medical industry that isn't really interested, in large part, isn't really interested at getting to the root cause of our problems. Instead, they are eager to just write you the next prescription. Why? Well, in many cases, writing the next prescription means more profit, means more commission, means more kickbacks, means more incentives. And that this is the ultimate perversion of our medical industry. If you had to pinpoint one unethical perversion of America's medical industry over the history of our country, it is the financial incentivizing of prescription meds. I mean, does nobody else see the conflict here? It's one thing to have a commission on, hey, you sell a car, you get a commission. You sell a house, you get a commission. But all these examples are not dealing with people's lives. It's not dealing with people's life or death. But we've entered this capitalism philosophy into the medical industry, and boy, that can go wrong in so many ways. And we've got the insurance disaster. I mean, the medical insurance fiasco that it is, unaffordable, inefficient. And then you've got government inserting itself through Obamacare and through Medicaid and Medicare. And so as you consume the news, as you look at the headlines of the day, you have to ask yourself, before you get all worked up about the measles outbreak and whatever CNN tells you should be your latest concern of the day, please, for the sake of your sanity, ask yourself, is this a real problem? Is this a real problem? And what you'll find is 90% of the time, the answer is no, this is not a real problem. Instead, here are the other things that actually are a real problem that our country should be working to fix. And I just went through four or five of them. There's dozens more. And so let's focus on things that actually matter. And it's not the measles outbreak. We'll see you next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.